Hey, Black and Published family, it's Nikisha. I want to say thank you for rocking with me these last few years. Over the course of these 5 seasons, I've shared with you the journeys of countless writers, including myself. I've told you about starting out as a self-published author and when my first nonfiction book came out in 2022. I have a new novel coming out in January entitled The 7 Daughters of Dupree. The story is a generational epic about the secrets kept between mothers and daughters over the course of 7 generations, told backwards in time from 1995 to 1860, and it's available for pre-order now, everywhere you get your books. I am beyond excited for this novel. It is my first Big 5 book, more on that later, and I'd like to make it a success, and I need your help to do that. If you can, please consider pre-ordering The 7 Daughters of Dupree today. Now let's get to the episode.
I think as Black writers, as Black authors, we have to move the industry as well and to say that there's a multitude of Black stories out there. And there are so many ways to tell Black stories through our lens and our perspective.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published on the Mahogany Books Podcast Network, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Nancy Johnson, the author of the novel People of Means. It's a dual timeline historical fiction novel about the choices a mother and daughter make as they pursue excellence in a time of intense activism.
Frida was torn. She had the messages and the expectations of her parents on one shoulder, then on the other side trying to break out and be her own woman as a young college student. But then when she has a daughter, Tula, she's fearful, but also wanting the best for her and not wanting anything to get in the way of this carefully crafted life that they've made possible for her.
Nancy spent 11 years as a television reporter before shifting to PR and now novel writing. What triggered her to start telling stories of her own instead of the ones prepackaged for a brand or newscast? Plus, the hidden history she learned on a phone call with the late, great Nikki Giovanni that inspired one timeline in the novel. And the challenge she faces as a Black author as she tries to get her work in front of more Black readers. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. All right. So, Nancy, welcome to Black and Published. My first question for you is, when did you know that you were a writer?
I knew I was a writer when I was a little girl, probably 6, 7 years old, when the teacher would ask you to write about what you did over your summer vacation. And I would take a lot of time writing that. It was something that was very creative, usually. And I just loved putting words together for those class assignments. And I always got good grades on them. So I knew then that I had a knack for writing. But then, of course, I later on started publishing pieces. But it was those early classroom assignments that got me going and have helped me to know that this was a gift I had.
When you say later on you started publishing pieces, what kind of things were you publishing and at what age?
Well, when I was in high school, actually, when I first entered high school, one thing, I grew up Catholic. And so the priest at the local church we attended asked me to start doing scripture reflections. And so I would write those scripture reflections. I was about 14 years old, and then they were published in the church bulletin every Sunday. And the funny thing is that one Sunday, my mom got a call from one of the older ladies in the church who asked her, she said, "I read what your daughter wrote. Are these now the teachings of the Catholic Church?" And my mother heard the alarm in that lady's voice. And because I was writing about issues of injustice and social justice and connecting that to the gospel. And my mother assured her, no, those are just my daughter's views, not the official teachings of the Catholic Church, even though, of course, I believe those should have been the teachings of the Catholic Church. So that was my first foray into having something published that was in the church bulletin. But then after that, I started writing for a citywide youth newspaper in Chicago called New Expression. So I did that when I was in high school and ended up becoming the managing editor of the paper. And we covered all kinds of issues to give teenagers in the city a voice. So we were talking about school reform and abortion and birth control and drug abuse and all of these really heavy issues we were covering. So that was really where I was getting published more officially.
So like, it seems to me like you've always had an opinion and perspective on things, whether it was just like an op-ed or a more hard-hitting journalist kind of piece. When did you know that you wanted to be like a novelist?
I didn't know until after my journalism career. So after college, I became a television news reporter. I did that for 11 years at CBS and ABC affiliates in different markets around the country. And after that, I moved into public relations. But I realized I didn't want to continue to just tell the stories that were making news or the stories of the organization I was working for to promote a brand. That was fine to get paid and for that to be my stability, you know, for my income. But I really wanted to tell stories of my own imagination, write about the things that keep me up at night that I'm thinking about often. And so it was really after the journalism career that I started thinking about wanting to write fiction, but I didn't have any experience writing fiction. I was a storyteller because I got the storytelling chops for my news career. But while that was very helpful, writing fiction is a whole nother animal. And I had to learn how to do that. I did a lot of writing workshops and conferences around the country to perfect my craft.
And as you were doing those workshops and working to perfect your craft at writing fiction, was the story that became your debut novel always on your mind?
No, that wasn't always on my mind. I didn't know initially what I wanted to write about. But what happened was I kept going back to 2008 and the lead up to the election of Barack Obama as the first Black president. And social media was pretty new back then. And I remember being on Facebook, which was also very new at the time, and just seeing this huge divide between Black and white America. I always knew there was the divide. That's been there for forever. But to see it playing out on my social media feed, it just made it so much more real and poignant for me. And I wanted to explore that. And so that's where the idea for my debut novel, The Kindest Lie, came from. I wanted to look at what is really going on in the perspectives of Black and white America, because I was seeing in social media that we were all coming at things, particularly that election, from very different viewpoints. And I knew I wanted to explore it, but through the lens of fiction, because I think when you're writing characters and story, people can really sink into that more. And it helps them to be able to talk about and to interrogate really tough issues without feeling defensive about it. And so I told the story of a successful Black woman engineer named Ruth and her family, and then this poor young white boy named Midnight. And he's in this dying Indiana factory town, and the two of them meet and their lives intersect in 2008 at the time of all this great hope with the election of our first Black president, but also this economic recession as well. So I think when you have this economic depression or recession, it exacerbates racial tensions. And so that was the perfect environment for my first novel.
And finding that outlet from your career as a journalist and even in PR, what kind of freedom did you find on the page to be able to explore the issues that were reported on, but not with the nuance or the depth or the complexity that fiction allows?
When you're writing your own piece, your own fiction, your own novel, you certainly have that freedom and that control. But when you're traditionally published, you are writing to a market and you do have a publishing house that you are also beholden to. There's the matter of what is going to sell, what's going to be marketable. And so in that sense, you're writing what you want to write, but it's also, you know, within the confines of the publishing industry. So sometimes there's limits on freedom even then, but I must say that I'm with William Morrow for HarperCollins and they have been terrific to work with. I have a dynamic, wonderful editor there, Liz Stein, and she has been very supportive. But I remember those initial conversations when I turned in my initial draft of The Kindest Lie, and she gave me feedback. And I knew there were some things I wanted to talk about as relates to race and Blackness and wanting to explain why I had made some of the choices that I'd made on the page. And I was nervous going into that because she had other notes about like suspense and character development and plot and all those other things that are so important. But I knew I wanted to initially talk with her about some of those cultural pieces first, just because I was nervous and I needed to get that off my chest first. And once I explained why I'd made the choices I made, she was so supportive and said, oh, but of course, this is great. And then I remember months later when the copy editor was reviewing The Kindest Lie, he made note of this one scene where my main character, Ruth, was talking about going on a date and she wanted to make sure that the young man that she was dating didn't have a girlfriend already. And she said something to him about, hey, stop trying to act brand new. And that's just more cultural. It's not necessarily Black. But the copy editor made note of it and said, well, okay, I see what you're saying there. Why not say, stop trying to be innocent acting? And instead of saying brand new. And my editor, Liz, she jumped in the comments before I could and said, no, it's clear from the context. This stays. And so that goes to show that once you develop a relationship and you can really help each other to understand, it goes a long way.
Before we get too deep into the publishing process, I want to ask about People of Means. When you were writing The Kindest Lie, did you always know that you wanted to follow up with People of Means, or where did that story come from, that iterative process?
I had such a wonderful debut experience with The Kindest Lie. I knew that I wanted to be a career author and that I wanted to write another book. I didn't know initially what that would be. And it's usually whatever I'm thinking about, whatever is the burning thought that is keeping me up at night. And so the summer of 2020, with the murder of George Floyd, I saw so many people getting involved in activism from every walk of life. And I kept wondering, what is it that sparks people to activism? And then a few months later, after that murder, Representative John Lewis died. And he was this larger-than-life elder statesman to me. But I watched a documentary about his life, and they were talking about him being 19 years old on a college campus in Tennessee, leading those sit-ins at the five and dime lunch counters that would really help launch the civil rights movement in many ways. I kept wondering, what was that like to be that young and doing something that monumental when most of us as college students here just trying to figure out your class schedule, your syllabus, your dating, you're making friends, you're doing all these other things. But this was some really heavy stuff that he was involved in. And so I knew I wanted to explore that. And so that was really the impetus for People of Means, for the 1959-1960 storyline of Frida, who is a student at Fisk University in Nashville. She comes from Chicago by train, and she's just thrust in this environment where all of this unrest is happening and the civil rights movement is getting going, and there are these sit-ins that are happening, and she's trying to make a decision about whether or not to get involved or not. But then the other timeline is in the 1990s, and that's a 1992 storyline. And that came from my own experience as a college student at Northwestern University. And I participated for the very first time in a protest march. And that was with my fellow students protesting the verdict in the Rodney King case, right after the acquittal of those officers who beat Rodney King. And so that was my first taste of activism. And so I wanted to show this juxtaposition of resistance and activism in the 1950s and 60s with this mother, Frida, and then 3 decades later with her daughter, Tulip, who is dealing with something very similar, but at a different time period. And Tulip is also grappling with how involved or not to get in activism. She's this young public relations professional, again, drawing upon my own experience in PR from back in the day. And she's trying to rise up the corporate ladder, trying to get promoted. Nobody at her office seems to give a damn about what's really going on with this verdict and what the ramifications of that are. But she wants to get involved and has this burning desire to, but she has to decide, is she willing to take the risk that's going to be involved with actually engaging in activism?
Yes. And so you spoke briefly before about when you entered the publishing industry with The Kindest Lie after getting your agent and securing the deal with William Morrow at HarperCollins, that you had, I guess, a bit of trepidation about how the racial and cultural issues would be received. And whatever you began with The Kindest Lie, you have definitely continued with People of Means. And so in finding that perhaps your comfort zone or where you like to explore in fiction is that intersection of race and class and culture, do you find that the industry is receptive beyond just your editor and your team?
My editor and team are very receptive to what I want to write. But when I look at publishing as a whole, I think that there's sometimes this desire for Black writers to focus on Black pain and Black struggle. And I focus on some of that too, but I'm also very intentional about incorporating moments of Black joy, because I think that's a big part of what it means to be Black. You know, we're not always encased in a constant struggle because of racism in America, which is really the original sin of America. But in the midst of that, the way we survive and thrive in that quite often is in joy, is in how we connect with our families and our friends. And I'm always careful to depict that. But I think as Black writers, as Black authors, we have to move the industry as well and to say that there's a multitude of Black stories out there. And there are so many ways to tell Black stories through our lens and our perspective. And I think at this moment in time right now, there's so much of a movement to erase Black history, to erase the contributions of Black people. And it's up to us as Black creators to keep those stories alive and to tell those stories in complex, nuanced ways and keep them at the forefront. So I'm not going to depend on an industry to do that for me. I'm going to try to push that and do that myself. But that being said, I don't ever want to write stories to be didactic. So I don't consider this resistance work or that I'm writing, you know, movement work or anything like that. But I'm just being honest and asking the right questions, I think, and exploring issues that I want to know more about. And I work through it and I explore it on the page. And hopefully it connects with all kinds of readers. I know I have quite a few white readers who talk to me about learning about the Black experience. For example, I did a book club with all white women book club recently to discuss People of Means, and they all enjoyed it. But one of the women from that book club said to us all, she said, "Nancy, you know, you talked about Tulip in 1992, enduring all of these racial microaggressions at the PR agency where she's working." And she said, "I worked at a bank in Chicago in the 90s, and none of that was happening there." And then everybody gave her the side eye, right? And then after some discussion, she eventually came to the point of, "Wow, I now, after talking with you, understand that racial microaggressions were very likely happening at that bank in the 90s. They just weren't happening to me as a white woman, right? They were happening to my Black colleagues." And so through fiction, she and others are able to walk in the shoes of people whose life experiences are different. And you're able to have some empathy for it because you're experiencing it through the lens of fiction.
Is that daunting for you when you don't see the audience that you're writing about in the audience where you're talking about the book?
I am always trying to reach Black readers, and that can sometimes be a challenge. It is that I've talked with my publishing team about. We need to be very intentional. We need to make a concerted effort to connect with Black readers, because I know Black women and all kinds of Black folks are really into reading, right? That's one of the largest and fastest growing reading groups. But sometimes it's hard to reach our community. And I don't know what the answer is. I do know that there are some online Black book clubs. And I know there are groups out there that are curating Black books and bringing Black readers together. But I just think we have to do more to bring our stories to them, because I do speak to Black book clubs, particularly Black women book clubs. And you're right, the conversation is very different in those groups because we have that common history, the common culture, the common understanding, even if we might come from different parts of the country where there might be some differences in how we grew up, or there might be some socioeconomic differences. But there is just something about stories that are rooted in Blackness that we are able to speak a common language. And there's a common way that we are able to look at life and a common understanding of struggle that we're able to have. And so the experience is different. Whereas I find with other groups that I speak with, particularly, you know, if I'm talking about white women, in some cases, there's a lot more educating going on. And I know that can be tough for us as Black creators to feel, or just Black people in general, to feel that burden that we have to educate. Like, why do we have to educate other people? But I do think that's part of my calling as a fiction writer, is to help spark these meaningful conversations for people. And so that means something to me, and I don't take that light.
I want to hit on what you said about working with your team to make a concerted effort to reach out to Black readers. I don't know if you have an answer to this question or even an opinion, but I'm going to tread on out here. What do you think is the resistance in the publishing industry to reaching out to Black audiences and Black readers and assuming that the standard by which a book is going to be made is by white women?
I can only go by the people that I know in publishing, but also writing organizations that I have been a part of and that I am a part of. So in both cases, I believe there is a desire on the part of many of these folks to reach Black audiences. But what I usually get is they don't know how. They're not sure how to go about doing it. And what I usually tell people is it's about having the relationships, right? It's not just, oh, let's send an email. Let's just mail a book out to these places and hope for the best. Or for a writing organization to say, you know, we are diverse, everybody's welcome. You have to build relationships, and it takes time. It's not something you do overnight. You have to get to know people in the community. You have to build trust over time and really just be intentional about those relationships and those partnerships, getting to know the Black-owned bookstores. And it just takes a little extra effort to put the time in if you really want to make that happen. And so I just think that's the answer. It's a really relationship-driven situation. And then I think also it's who is in publishing too, right? Who are the gatekeepers? We need more Black editors who are making the decisions about what books are being acquired by a publishing house. We need more Black agents who are determining, you know, who are the authors that are going to be presented and having their manuscripts presented to acquiring editors. We need more Black folks doing publicity and marketing because they will bring a different lens to that particular facet of the business. So it's really needing to have our voices represented at every stage. So it's not just about having more Black authors, but also having Black folks throughout the publishing industry who are making some of those key decisions. And I think once the face of publishing changes and we get more of those voices, then some of those other things are going to naturally occur, because you're going to have people who understand the Black community because that's their community, right? And so they're going to bring that perspective to it.
Sounds a lot like the cross the divide work that had to happen to bring the civil rights movement to bear and then to push racial justice more forward after the Rodney King verdict. And for a time after the murder of George Floyd, although we have seen a complete regression in this year of our Lord, 2025. But those are issues that you touch on in People of Means and were inspired by to even write this novel. So can you read something from it so that we can dive into the book?
Sure, I'm happy to read.
People of Means by Nancy Johnson is a historical fiction dual timeline novel set between Nashville in 1959 and Chicago in 1992. Anchored on Frida and Tulip, Nancy explores what happens as these women come of age in their own time, exploring the realms of their social and love lives at a time of crisis and mobilization for racial equity. Here's Nancy.
This is part one, Nashville, 1959. Frida. On day one, Frida Gilroy stared up into the face of a woman more formidable than her own mother, standing in the line of 78 young ladies on the first floor of Jubilee Hall. Frida's legs quaked under the watchful gaze of their house mother. Even if dunked in a bucket of water, Mother Cain's probably weighed no more than 90 pounds, her silver curls standing in stark contrast to her midnight black skin. She had to be in her 70s, but women were not forthcoming with those details, and Black women aged better than most, so one couldn't be certain. Either way, She cut as sharp as the blade of a chef's knife. If I get so much as a whiff of defiance or disobedience, you will be on a train back to whatever godforsaken town dared send its worst to the best university in the world. Her voice reverberated from the high ceilings of this ornate dormitory for freshman girls at Fisk University, and Frida found the words of Mother Gaines both chilling and inspiring. The night before she left home for college, her father came into her bedroom while she was folding a wool sweater and packing it in her suitcase. He pulled a money clip from his pocket and peeled off a crisp $20 bill. And when he slid that money into her hand, he hugged her close, whispering, "You will be fine, baby girl. You are now part of a great tradition of excellence, a Negro aristocracy."
Thank you. So you mentioned that the story is inspired in part by the sit-ins that were led at the lunch counters by college students in the late 50s and early 60s, which was the spark to the larger civil rights movement, as well as the Rodney King trial. I believe in the author's note, you talk about a story from Nikki Giovanni, or Nikki Giovanni told you, that, like, I bet you all find this in the history books, about how the movement was funded. Can you talk about that piece a bit?
Sure. I'll talk a little bit about it without trying not to give too any spoilers in there. But I was just so fortunate to have the opportunity to talk with the late, great Nikki Giovanni. We were both published by William Moore HarperCollins. And so I asked my editor, when I was writing this book that centered Fisk University, I said, I would love to talk to Nikki Giovanni. And she reached out to Nikki's editor and made that happen. And so I got on that call with Nikki Giovanni, and I was terrified because she could be a bit intimidating. She suffers no fools. And I was just like, oh my gosh, she's going to think I'm an idiot. Who knows what she's going to think of me? But I just wanted to find out from her what the experience was like as a student at Fisk during this time of great activism, because I think so many of us believe that we know everything there is to know about the civil rights movement because it's been out there, it's in our history books, it's in the news. But I wanted to know the perspective of someone who was on the campus of Fisk around that time. She came along a little later than Frida did, but she was there as part of that. And she was able to give me a lot of great insights. And part of that was about entertainers, one in particular being Nat King Cole. And she did say that so many people thought that he was a sellout, but that he actually was doing some things behind the scenes for the movement and supporting the movement. She also told me about the role of the Pullman porters, the African-American men who worked on the railroads. And they were really so responsible for the rise of the Black middle class at that time. I mean, that was a very coveted position. They didn't earn much respect because so many of those white passengers were calling them George, regardless of what their real name was, and treating them with such disrespect. But these were proud, dignified brothers. And she talked to me about the role of the Pullman porters in the movement. And that's something I didn't know about either. So there were so many stories that she was able to tell me. And I said, oh my goodness, I was writing everything down that she was saying. And I said, I can't wait to get off the call so that I can look these things up. I want to Google and look up everything. And she said, child, you're not going to find this in any history books, I'm telling you. And she said it just that way. And my regret is that, you know, she didn't get a chance to read the book because she passed beforehand, but her imprint is on it.
At the end of the section that you read, you talk about how Frida's father welcomed her into this beautiful aristocracy, and you title the book People of Means. What do you mean by people of means?
I love book titles, and I've gotten so lucky with book titles. So for both of my novels, the title that I selected was a title that stuck. And so for me, people of means, on the surface level, it's about the socioeconomic status of Frida and Tulip. They're middle class, upper middle class folks. But people of means on a deeper level is about our capacity to love, our capacity to live our lives out loud and on purpose, to build community, to resist to make the change that we want to see in the world. And by that definition, I believe that we all can be people of means. And so that's the layered, more nuanced meaning of the title of the book. Also, let me say that I thought it was kind of a cool flex to title a book about Black people, People of Means. And I remember when I announced the title of the book on social media, I have a few Black authors saying, oh yeah, I like that. I like that. You know, there's just this sense of pride that it's a bit of a flex to do that. Because of course, we have been all the different socioeconomic brackets, but I think sometimes the larger community thinks Black and they think lower class or poor people. And we're not a monolith. We are on every rung of the socioeconomic ladder. And so I just thought that was kind of cool.
So we've had this like high level discussion about the book and some of its themes, but I want to get into a bit of the nitty gritty because I don't like Frida's husband.
A lot of people can't.
I don't like that man. I don't like that man.
That is so funny. Well, that's interesting. So yeah, so we'll give that part away, that the man she marries in some people's minds turns out to be a bit of a villain in the book. But I try to write characters that are going to be layered and complex and nuanced so that this particular man, he makes certain choices that might be questionable, but I want people to understand where he's coming from and what motivates the choices that he makes. And so I see you can't see her, but she's rolling her eyes over here at that. She's like, I don't think so. No redeeming qualities there.
No, it's not that he doesn't have redeeming qualities. And from his point of view, I understand his action. The novel is dual timeline. And so when you meet Frida in the 90s timeline, she's this very quiet, very demure woman who's all about respectability and all of these things. And it's almost like she doesn't have any agency in her own life. But the Frida in 1959, 1960, before that man was in complete control of everything that she wanted to do and felt. And I'm just like, I feel like something was taken from her in her marriage by her husband that she's continuing to support. I don't like that man.
That's a really good point, because you do see a change in Frida because she doesn't have as much agency based on the choices that she's made. She's made certain choices because, you know, it's a tough choice. Where is her life going to go? And there is a love triangle in there. And so the decision of which man to be with also determines what her future is going to be and what she chooses for her path.
She was forced into that path. But
which we're not going to get into.
I won't spoil it, but you know, I don't like that man.
People have to read it and then you can let us know what you think of the two men in Frida's life. One is Darius, who is a saxophone playing civil rights activist. And then the other is Gerald, who is a medical student at Meharry Medical College. And he is the man that her parents want her to marry. And so she's got a choice between these two men that she meets her freshman year at Fisk.
And then even in all that Frida has gone through in her life, when we get to the timeline with her daughter, Tulip, who was a grown woman and is in this relationship with this blue-collar man whose family has opened their own beauty supply store, which I love that they own a beauty supply store on the South Side. That just gave my heart joy. No. As a frequenter of those stores on Stony Island. Okay.
Stony Island.
Frida gives Tulip so much shit for like dating this blue collar man and acting as if her daughter doesn't want better for herself. And she knows that experience. I guess my question here is, in showing how Frida changed over time and settled into this life of Jack and Jill and the Lynx and all of these things and raising her child in that similar experience, were you trying to show that this aristocracy or these people of means have ingrained these flaws and are passing them down instead of allowing who they used to be before they settled to live on in their children?
Mm-hmm. Yes, to all of that. I was trying to show the generational differences, but also I want to show that a lot of times we repeat the things that our parents have done, even if they were stifling and limiting. I think once someone becomes a parent themselves, they are looking at the world through a different prism. Rita is not looking at the world the way she was as an idealistic college student in the 50s and the 60s, right? Who was somewhat open to activism and going out and taking the world by storm and doing what you wanted to do in life. But now she has a daughter, and the way she's viewing things now is the way her parents viewed them when they were looking at her, and they were fearful for her. And they were like, we sent you to Fisk University, one of the greatest universities in the world, to get your education, to be excellent that way, not to be sullied by activism. And that's how we lift the race, is by excellence. And we support our community in that way. And so that was the message Frida was getting. She was torn. She had the messages and the expectations of her parents on one shoulder, then on the other side, trying to break out and be her own woman as a young college student. But then when she makes her decision that she has a daughter, Tula, she's fearful also for her. And she fearful, but also wanting the best for her and not wanting anything to get in the way of this carefully crafted life that they've made possible for her. They have sacrificed. They've gone through a lot that she will never know about. It'll never be as hard for Tulip as it was for them in the 50s and the 60s. We've gone through this. We've fought these battles. And now you are reaping the benefits of that. You know, we couldn't be working in a PR firm in the 50s and 60s. Now you have the opportunity to be a public relations professional. Your father made the right calls and he helped you get that job. And now you are on the track for promotion. Don't mess that up over something that's happening over out in LA and you're not happy about a verdict, right? Your head together.
Going all in the projects late at night.
All
in the Ida B. Wells.
All in the Ida B. Wells. And that, right? And that shows too, kind of the different types of, you know, different Black folks, and everybody doesn't fit in every community. She was an outsider there, you know? She's Black, but they're like, what are you doing? Who are you? Are you 5-0? What's up?
They know when you don't belong in a project, child.
Okay. You can't even fake it.
I wonder, could you talk about that divide of trying to lift the race through excellence? This is a theme of the book, but not necessarily about the book specifically, but with where we are now in 2025 and all that is happening in history and culture that we are living through every day. Do you think there is any amount of excellence or Black exceptionalism that can lift the race more than what activism and movement work can?
Ooh, that's a good one. Black women in particular are the most educated, highly educated group that is out there. So we have all of these degrees. Black men have degrees. We are degreed up in many ways, but that doesn't inoculate us from racism in America. So I don't think Black excellence alone, as important as Black excellence is going to be the answer to that. I think there are lessons to be learned from the civil rights movement, from those sit-ins and the precursor to that, and just the level of unity and organization that happened. And what makes me proud is that I see some of that happening now, and also some of the debates over it in our social media feeds when you look at Target and these other stores and the boycott. And I see in social media the discussions, and I smile because I think about the discussions and the debates that are happening now about how we approach Target, very similar to the discussions that were happening in the 50s and the 60s about what's the right way to approach this. How do we resist in a way that's going to be the most effective and the most impactful? Because you had the bus boycott, right? The Montgomery bus boycott. And that was more than a year that Black folks made the decision that we are not going to ride public transportation. We're going to find another way to get where we need to go. And there was unity in that, and it had an impact, obviously. So I think there's a way to do both of those. But I think the conversations that we're having are very, very interesting, and I think they are important to be having these kinds of debates on how to do it, what's going to be effective. Because we don't have a quote-unquote leader like some of the people that we had back in the day, right, when there were certain people you could point to and say, these are the leaders of the movement, or these are the legacy organizations that people are going to look to. But even back then with those organizations, there was some infighting, and NAACP may not always agree with what SNCC was saying and all of that. And we had to find a way to come together and to negotiate how we were going to move through that and be effective as a community.
With the fact that your historical fiction novel speaks so much to the present day and the conversations that we are having about Target, about activism, about movement work, about Black excellence, about where we spend our time and money and how we excel and get ahead, what do you want readers to take away from The People of Mean?
I really want people to ask themselves questions about resistance, what that looks like in their own lives. I think sometimes when people look at movement work, it feels overwhelming because people usually think of those iconic figures that they always hear about, like the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s, the Malcolm X's, those figures, and they feel that I'm no King, I'm no Malcolm X, I can't do that. I'm no Fannie Lou Hamer. I'm not the person who can do that. But I want people to know that there's a lot of ways to resist, and you can do it in large and small ways. And there are different ways that people go about doing this. You don't have to make the choice to be out there with a picket sign and to be joining up with Black Lives Matter and these other movement organizations, that there are other ways that you can do it, quiet, small ways in your own spheres of influence, that you can still have an impact. I think that's important. And I just want people to start thinking about some of these issues and just raising the questions and having conversations in your communities. I mentioned the white readers that have connected with it and learned a lot about the different experiences of Blackness in America. I also want Black readers to see themselves on the page. I want them to see different types of Black people and different experiences on the page. That's something that I hear from Black readers quite often, is they say you don't just tell the stories of one kind of Black person, right? That you've got people from different lifestyles, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different ways of being Black. And so that's important to me as well, is how I portray our community on the page. I grew up not really seeing myself represented in books, and I want people who look like me to see themselves reflected in the literature.
So I want to move to a speed round, a little game before I let you go for the morning. What is your favorite book?
One of my favorites is The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, Salvage the Bones by Jesmyn Ward. I think about Esh, the maid character, that young woman, and all the time, I wonder how Esh is doing. So yeah, I will say those two are two of my absolute favorites.
Who is your favorite author?
Again, Toni Morrison, Jesmyn Ward, Jacqueline Woodson, Dennis Lehane, crime fiction writer. More recently, the person I love is S.A. Cosby, Sean Cosby.
Who is your favorite artist?
I love Luther Vandross. And I hate that I never got to see him in concert, but his music makes me feel good and it's very soothing. So I'm going to go with Luther.
What do you think is the best book to movie or book to series adaptation?
My favorite would be Queen Sugar. I thought the book was very good. And then I thought that the way Ava DuVernay and team reimagined that as a series was just phenomenal. And it just has so much layering and depth and complexity to it, and kept me coming back, you know, every time to watch every episode of that. It was beautifully done.
If People of Means got the screen treatment, who would you want to play Frida and Tulip?
I love Viola Davis. I think she's brilliant. And it's so funny because I'm older now. I'm thinking of like older actresses and they couldn't play some of the younger characters. I think of what's the young woman's name who was the sister in Black Panther.
Letitia.
Is that her name?
Her first name is Letitia something.
Okay. Well, I could see her playing Tulip.
Okay.
If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
I love North Carolina. I did my graduate work there. I'd probably live somewhere, some beautiful remote part of North Carolina, and just be holed up in the house writing all the time, maybe visiting the beach and that kind of thing. But writing and then get going out occasionally to speak as well. Just being able to do my own thing, not have to necessarily work a 9-to-5 job. I think that's the thing. Have the freedom to live where I want. But also maybe be a bit of a digital nomad and you can move around the different places, because I would love to explore just more of the United States and be able to work and write from multiple places in the country. But I've always thought North Carolina was beautiful, and the way they experience the seasons there, that's some place I would love to build a home there and write.
Name three things on your bucket list.
Be a full-time writer, build a speaking career, and have more years to make memories with my mother, who has Alzheimer's. Yeah.
What brings you joy?
Connecting with people where there's a spark, and we're able to have a conversation about art, about, when I say art, I mean the writing, and we connect about it, especially strangers, people I don't know, and we're able to just connect and spark, like this conversation with you is bringing me joy, just where you have these commonalities with people, and it's like you're speaking the same language, even though you're coming to the work from different perspectives and different life experiences. Those moments are bringing me so much joy right now, because that's what I'm experiencing on book tour, are just all these moments of joy and the people that I meet. It fills my heart.
What brings you peace?
Peace comes from knowing that I'm living and working in my purpose, my God-given purpose. And I know that I am.
All right. So our game is called Rewriting the Classics. Classic is however you define it. Name one book you wish you would have written.
I would say The Bluest Eye is a book that I wish I would have written. It was just so well done, and I study it like a textbook. And so I wish I just had that flair to be able to write that way. And I didn't appreciate her and her work when I was in college reading Toni's work. But it wasn't until later that I began to appreciate her.
Name one book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
I would say Razorblade Tears. I cried like a baby at the end. And that's just because of the outcome for a particular character in the book. The writing was beautiful, and the way it was done, it shouldn't be changed. But I would only change it for selfish reasons, because of what I wanted, a different outcome for one of the characters. And it just broke my heart. And so I would want to change that outcome, just for a purely selfish point of view.
And so my little messy question, name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught, and why?
The only book that I can think of, and that was from back in the day, 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, there are reasons that people like us like that book, but I was like, well, what's going on with that?
You know?
So I don't know. That's a bad answer. But that's the only thing I can really think of, because that book did so well. But I give her props. I mean, she hit upon something that sparked in people. But I was like, wow, really? Like, why? Wait, what was it? But sometimes it's just the right time.
It was the sex.
It was like, it was just the sex.
It was the sex.
It's not like a Zane. Like, why didn't any of her books do that? Like, I don't know. Like, I mean, there's a lot of erotica out there, but what was it about that particular book?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of books out there that depict sex, but there's something about that book that caught on to people's imaginations, and everybody was buying it, but at the time.
Mm-hmm. So final question for today. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
Oh, I would like for somebody to say that Nancy wrote novels that explored universal truths, that she made people think and reflect and feel something, and that she sparked meaningful conversations about things that matter in the world, and that she inspired people to be their most human and authentic selves.
Big thank you to Nancy Johnson for being here today on Black and Published. You can follow Nancy on the socials at
Nancy J. Author on Instagram and Facebook. And make sure you check out People of Means, out now from William Morrow. You can get a copy of the novel from Mahogany Books and get 10% off your first purchase using code BLACKPUB at checkout. That's BLKPUB. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Nancy about the full circle moment she's having thanks to the amazing work of the late, great Nikki Giovanni. Make sure you check it out. Let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Laura Pegram, the editor of Sing the Truth, the Quaylee Journal short story collection.
I still feel as if Quaylee is this underground entity. There are pockets of people here and there that know of us who submit work to us, but I still feel as if there are a large number of folks who still don't quite know who we are and what we do and what we plan to do in the future. So hopefully this book will help change that.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.